There's a lot of things producers can look at, even on the very simple side. If you're feeding silage or another feedstuff, just trying to minimize your wastes. So, you know, are you covering your bales? Are you covering your silage properly? Because even those little bits that you have to trim off the front of their silage pack, they add up over time and can amount to a lot of feed loss.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible. Virbac, committed to growth. For information, visit vet-us.virbac.com/cattle or see your Virbac representative. Be proactive with Cattle Active. Visit proearthanimalhealth.com today. Healthy Farms by Bioverse, your manure management experts. Contact us for time and labor-saving solutions. Data shows most cattle don't get enough vitamin D, which can impact health and performance. High D from DSM Firmenich can help improve cattle's vitamin D status.
Welcome to the Beef Podcast. I am one of your hosts, Brandy Buzzard, and it's my pleasure to bring you the trending issues and topics with the best and brightest minds of the beef industry. Today, we are joined by Dr. Katie Wood, Associate Professor in the Department of Animal Biosciences at the University of Guelph. Dr. Wood earned her master's and PhD from the University of Guelph and her postdoctoral fellowship from the University of Saskatchewan. Dr. Wood specializes in cow feed efficiency, gut health, methane emissions, and much more. We are so happy to have her on the podcast today to dive into some of those topics. So Dr. Wood, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, we're really excited to get to dive into some of these topics, a very wide variety of things that you specialize in. But to start with, before we jump into those things, can you tell us a little bit about how you got involved in the beef industry and your career path so far? I know I touched on it a bit in the bio, but that was really brief. So could you, if you just want to, you know, give us your background and your history, I guess.
Yeah, sure. So a little bit of unusual history. I didn't technically grow up on the farm, but my grandparents had a purebred Simmental operation and did a lot of showing when we were young. And as you do, I started in 4-H and in their Simmental Breed Association showing cattle and quickly became very passionate about it and stayed in 4-H throughout my years, and then decided that I wanted to pursue agriculture as a career. And I was always kind of a nerdy kid too. So when I found out that I could like blend cattle with science, it was like, yes, this is what I want. And then, yeah, I haven't really looked back. Still own a few cows and part ownership in a few cows, but I have to keep them at a friend's place because I don't have a farm of myself anymore. But yeah, certainly owe a lot to my grandparents and their interest in cattle and agriculture when I was young to lead me where I am today.
I think that probably could be, a lot of people could say that same thing, you know, that we owe a lot of the things that we're involved in or our love of something to our parents and grandparents, you know, along the way. I think that many of us probably share that same kind of thread.
Yeah. Yeah. And I tried to spend every waking moment that I could at their farm rather than at home. So it was, yeah, good time spent with my grandparents.
Well, that's great. Well, we're going to jump right into it. So the past few years across the beef industry, I mean, I don't live in Canada. Spoiler alert for our listeners. I live in the United States. But at least down here, inputs have really gotten very expensive over the past couple of years. And I'm assuming that that's similar in Canada. And so that has made feed efficiency even more crucially important. And so I guess like to start off with, do you have any advice for producers who are looking to cut costs? So like save money on cows, but not cut productivity?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of things producers can look at, like even on the very simple side, you know, if you're feeding silage or you know, another feedstuff, just trying to minimize your wastes. So, you know, are you covering your bales? Are you covering your silage properly? Because even those little, you know, little bits that you have to trim off the front of their silage pack, they add up over time and can amount to a lot of feed loss. And so simple things like that to, you know, taking a better look at the commodities you have and doing some feed testing. Making sure you're aligning with what you have available to what your animal's requirements are. And, you know, there's particular times in the cow's life cycle where you can be a little thinner on your nutrition and get away with it. And that's kind of the opportunity that you can save some real feed costs and maybe using some alternative feeds, like a lot of crop residues I promote quite heavily. And again, trying to reduce those feed costs and help producers save money.
That's interesting that you bring up alternative feeds. Because I'm actually was working on an article on a different project about alternative feeds. So just briefly, like, what are some of the alternative feeds that you see in Canada that are, you know, that might not be different, you know, that we may not have down here in the United States? Because obviously agriculture is very regionally, you know, varied across regions.
Yeah, I mean, it's similar to the U.S. We're highly varied as well. Here in Ontario, we get a little bit warmer climate, so we have a lot of corn that we grow. And so feeding, you know, corn residue, turning cattle out on pasture this time of year to clean up corn is another way that you can reduce costs. One thing, again, in southern Ontario, because we get a little longer growing season than some of the rest of the country, is, you know, looking at systems like double cropping. So going in after wheat and putting in a second crop that you could either graze or use as take off as a forage crop is another way to kind of extend your land base kind of thing. Mm-hmm. We do things that most other areas would do too, like feeding crop residues. So, you know, incorporating straw into rations, opportunity feeds as well. So I'm not too far from Toronto, and, you know, we get a lot of food processing that happens kind of outside the city. So in the feedlot side, certainly you see a lot of bakery waste going into feedlots. So, you know, this time of year, everything's kind of peppermint scented, but those good things make their way to feedlots as well. Some parts of the province grow a lot of vegetables as well. So, you know, we'll see potatoes or carrots make their way into cattle feed also as an opportunity feed to try and reduce some feed costs. You know, basically, we're fairly diverse as well. So, you know, seeking some of those opportunities out. And, you know, I got a call the other week about someone that has a microbrewery and is looking to get rid of their distiller's grains. And I'm like, great, I know some feedlot guys that will easily take those off your hands. So,
right. Yeah.
Yeah. Lots of, we're fairly urban around here. So lots of kind of opportunity from byproduct feeds. We see a lot of.
I love that phrase that you used, opportunity feeds. I have never heard that before. I mean, I've heard the word opportunity, obviously, but I've never heard what I would normally just call like byproducts phrased as opportunity feeds. And I think that is just genius. Like, I'm going to start, I will credit you when I do this, but I'm going to start using that in like public.
I read it somewhere in some popular press article, and I was like, yes, that is exactly what they are. So I can't take credit, but I'm definitely passing it on.
Well, I have to give credit to you because I didn't read this article. So I'm going to start using this in like my social media stuff and in keynote speeches. Like, I love that, opportunity feeds, because that's what it is. Yeah. It's taking an opportunity. Like, you have the opportunity to use this feed to, you know, put more gain on your cattle or to reduce food waste on the human side or, you know, on the other ag product side. Like, I just love that. I wrote, while you were talking, I wrote it down and I circled it. So that is fabulous. Listeners, look for me to start using opportunity feed all the time. I love that. So I'm glad that you shared that with us. In terms of your research and cow feed efficiency, are you doing any research right now that you can share with us about feed efficiency in cows?
Yeah. So currently we've got a lot of projects looking at the relationship between methane emissions and feed efficiency. I mean, we know there's a close relationship there, but one of the things that I have some interest in is whether, you know, animals that are initially measured for their gas emissions, if that changes over their production cycle. And so we've been following this group of heifers. This will be the third year, and we've got the cows currently on trial. But we measured them, you know, before they had their first calf. We measured them with their calf at side. We measured them after weaning. And then, again, we're measuring them one more time, a full year from their last calf. And curious to see, you know, how if those animals that were initially, you know, either feed efficient or low emitters, if they continue to be such along their kind of productive life cycle. And fortunate enough to get some long-term funding on that, because certainly it's a 3-year project. So
it's not a 1-month thing.
yeah, exactly. So we're able to follow this cohort through. And initially, like we've seen, as we would expect, that the relationship between feed efficiency and, in this case, RFI, we ranked these heifers into RFI quartiles, and very strong relationships. And dry matter intake does a lot to influence both efficiency and methane emissions. So we're certainly following up with that. And we're fortunate that on our green feeders, we also measure CO2 and O2. So okay. We're looking at if we can use these measurements as another quick way to identify efficient animals, as opposed to doing a very long, 70-day feeding trial, where we would only need, a week or so on the green feeder to be able to identify calves that are efficient or inefficient. Mm-hmm. And maybe we don't need actual feed intake, so maybe we can do that out on pasture too, which would be kind of neat. So we're still working on the modeling for that, but I think it's going to work out.
Yeah, that's interesting. That would be interesting to have it out on pasture to measure that. You're it's like you saw my show notes, because you're just guiding us along so well through topic to topic. But I'm very passionate and invested about the role that cattle play in a sustainable food system. And while I am a huge proponent of the fact that like cattle have a very minimal effect on our climate as compared to transportation or industry or something like that, I think the industry is always going to continue to try to lower our already minimal impact. So through your work, you touched on it a little bit in that last answer, but like, would you care to expound about what you have learned about cattle and methane emissions, maybe in terms of like what specific feeds you see that reduce methane emissions, if there are feeds that increase them, maybe what you think is coming 5 years down the road or something like that?
Yeah. I mean, this is a super hot topic right now, and almost everyone in my field is doing some sort of this type of work, right? And we've done a little bit of work looking at some feed additives. Some work, some don't. One of the projects we just finished up, and my student, Katie Kay, is writing up the work now for an abstract. But I was also interested to see if animals respond the same to a mitigation strategy. Mm-hmm. So this concept of, individualized feeding programs. Do we need to feed some of these expensive feed additives to every member of the herd? Or is it maybe just a few of the higher emitters that can benefit from using a feed additive to reduce emissions? And yeah, we found that, the low emitters, when we use the mitigation strategy, which in this case was canola oil, others have used canola oil before. It is not inexpensive, which is the problem with many of the feed additives. It is not a cheap thing to feed, but it did lower emissions about 20%, which is kind of in line with what most people see with oil. It was about 6% of the diet. But some interesting things we saw was that it lowered the emissions about double in the already high emitters than the low emitters.
Wow.
So the magnitude of difference was quite a bit different between them. Right, yeah. We're already
That's huge. That's yeah. a huge difference. Yeah. I mean, 20% on its own is a huge difference. But then
yeah, that was the average of the two groups. But it was closer to 30 on the high emitting group, and closer to 10 or 11 in the low emitting group. So
wow.
Yeah. So yeah, learning some things and kind of simple questions relating to methane emissions, but important questions. And measuring emissions is hard anyways outside a research setting. So even kind of benchmarking some of these values for policymakers is also really important, I think, too. And so we're trying to do a good job of that and capturing all our data and make it available to those that make the policies.
Is that happening a lot in Canada right now? Like policies targeted at agriculture operations specifically?
Well, we have a carbon tax that's been implemented across the country, but there's a lot of political debate on it. And it seems like every day they change kind of where it's going. They've had most recently released some agricultural exemptions, but we don't really exactly know what's coming down the pipe. But I want to make sure that whatever it is, we have some data to back it up. Because as you say, cattle emissions are already quite low in Canada and the US. And so I don't want to get caught up in the global debate where we are already far superior to the global average.
Right.
So we need to make sure we have that data to support it.
Right. That's a great point. It was Dr. Jude Capper, who used to live in the United States, but now I believe she's back in the UK. If she's listening, please don't be upset with me, Dr. Capper, that I don't know exactly where you are. But I remember her saying one time, a long time ago, that like if more countries in the world raise beef the way that we do in the United States and like Canada, you know, that would overall lower global emissions from beef specifically. And I've never forgotten that, because it's just simple, like quote unquote simple stuff, like every cow having a calf every year, like that yes. has an impact, yeah. you know, using better genetics. And so that's just really stuck with me, because you said earlier, it's like simple questions, but like simple questions lay the basis of lay the foundation for the knowledge to build upon. So it's just interesting that you said that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I've heard that same thing as well. And you know, some of these relationships we know already, but, you know, farmers may be tentative about talking about emissions, but lowering methane emissions also improves your feed efficiency. So that's a good message for farmers to chase as well, even if they don't buy into the emissions, the greenhouse gas side of it, the environmental side of it.
I'm writing that down just so I can share that later. Lowering methane emissions also improves efficiency. I love that. Did I say that right? Lowering.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, okay.
That's what I thought you said. I wrote that one down. You're giving us a lot of great sound bites in this episode. Great. That's good. It's a good thing. So far we've talked about, pretty wide variety of things that hasn't really even like barely touched the tip of the iceberg for you on what you work on. And I'm sure that feedlots are closely related to both the idea of feed efficiency and reducing methane emissions. Do you care to share any insight on your work on rumen acidosis and gut barrier function? I don't know much about either of those topics. I am not I don't own a feedlot or work on a feedlot. I'm a half lady. So I'm very interested to learn more about some of these if these are feedlot specific problems or just share more about that, hear more about that.
Yeah, sure. So, I kind of do both cow-calf and feedlot in my role, and bringing with me out of my postdoc in the University of Saskatchewan, working with Dr. Greg Penner, who is a very good gut physiologist, and learned a lot of things from him and kind of carried that into my position here at Guelph, looking at some of these metabolic and gut health issues that our feedlot cattle seem to encounter. Which, if you have a gut that's sick and maybe inflamed, you're not absorbing as many nutrients as you can and likely impacting feed efficiency as well. And so, we've done some work. We've done a lot of work recently with yeast as a feed additive in the feedlot.
Okay.
And our initial study, one of the challenges with working with yeast is that there's so many different types, and every company has a different strain that they use at a different dose. So we really wanted to look at, one strain, one dose across a couple of different scenarios. Mm-hmm. We first tried it in kind of a more natural feeding system with no other additives. And it worked like gangbusters. Like we saw a huge improvement in feed conversion in our steers with the yeast additive. And so, it's not that common to see a lot of, natural based systems, in Canada, probably similar to the US. And so our next kind of group of studies was looking at how it performs with monensin and with tylosin in the diet. Okay. And we didn't see any of those large improvements like we did with our natural base system. But, you know, we didn't see any disadvantages either. So most of our work was done all in the research center. So we thought that, you know, that could be an opportunity maybe if animals were on a more commercial environment where they maybe, you know, have higher stocking density, have more environmental stress, that kind of thing, that maybe it work a little bit like an insurance policy and help with that. But there wasn't any huge improvement in performance or carcass traits. One other thing we did, working with Greg Penner as well, we did a study where we actually induced an acidosis challenge on some cannulated heifers. And we were interested to see how they recover from that acidosis challenge, with the theory being that, you know, the yeast maybe help speed up some of the recovery. Didn't end up being different from our controls, which maybe was expected with some of the results with the monensin we saw. But we did learn a lot about kind of the recovery of acidosis. And we ended up using a dosed marker into their rumen and then into the abomasum, so we could get, you know, whole tract barrier function, or if it was just happening in the hindgut. And we saw that actually the hindgut was quite impacted following the acidosis challenge, and even stayed fairly leaky for about up to about 15 days after that induced acidosis challenge.
Okay.
Which to me makes me think, okay, we always worry about the rumen. Maybe we need to start with looking at what's happening after the rumen. There could be some, you know, inflammation or something like that that's causing some gut health issues in those animals. So that was a cool result, even though our yeast didn't work. But we learned some things about acidosis anyways.
Right. I mean, that's what research is. It doesn't always tell you what you want to hear, but it does always tell you something.
Yep.
I do not, my master's is in animal well-being and behavior. So I did not do any nutrition work. My only work with rumen fluid was when I lived in Australia and had to stick my hand down in there and get some of it. But I don't know very much about it. But is most of the work been done? Like, I know that rumen acidosis, that work is done on the rumen. But has there been other, you know, you're talking about the abomasum and other stomachs. Has there been much work done on acidosis in the other stomachs?
There's a little bit around, you know, more recent work as well. So back when I first started my postdoc, one of the first things we were looking at is, you know, is barrier function different across the regions of the gut? And we found that, yes, in fact, there were regions that were quite leaky. The jejunum was one other that came up, as well as the cecum. And so, you know, that kind of historical thinking that this only happens in the rumen is starting to shift a little bit. And there's others that have published some work looking at histology changes relative to an acidosis challenge. A lot of it's coming out of the dairy side, because certainly dairy cattle are susceptible to acidosis as well, especially during transition. And so, I mean, we're learning from the dairy side as well. Although the acidosis can be quite different, because those dairy cattle are not on as high grain a diet as we would see in a feedlot. And so there could be some differences in, you know, how that acidosis kind of unveils, and if there's different region challenges, or, you know, it might not be about low pH either, because those well-adapted steers, even though they could have a very low pH, can still be very healthy and do quite well and have great performance because of that. And so we're learning more and more about that, but it's still probably a relatively new area, I would say.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it sounds like it. I mean, you are very knowledgeable on it, but for the amount of research that we know has been done on the rumen, you know, it's like a drop in the bucket. The other stomachs are like a drop in the bucket to that.
Yeah, exactly.
is do you foresee your research program and you and your colleagues maybe focusing more on that in the future? Or do you think you have higher priorities in other areas?
Well, on the feedlot side, definitely this is somewhere I want to keep looking at. You know, it starts to ask a question, right? Like, should we look at rumen protecting some of these additives so that they're functional in the hindgut? Mm-hmm. And certainly that's a newer area, but where we can use, you know, the concepts we know in nutrition to kind of try and tackle some of these other issues. And, you know, that's now we're in the hindgut. We can start looking at some of the monogastric data as well and look at maybe some feed additives that, you know, our chicken and pig producer friends are using and see if it there can be applicable to the beef industry also, because we can learn from each other on some of that as well.
No, that's interesting. That's it's just really interesting. I'm not in that world every day. So that's interesting to hear more about that.
Yeah.
When I was prepping for this podcast episode, there was something I was reading the website, the University of Guelph website with your information on it and such. And there was something there that piqued my interest, and that is lactocrine programming. I had never heard that, and I didn't even Google it because I wanted to come in completely with a blank space for it, for you to talk about it. Cause that, you know, again, I've never heard of it. So I'm just wondering if you can explain that for me and the rest of our audience, what I can't even hardly say it. Lactocrine programming is.
Yeah. So this is a kind of a new word out there as well. And this stems from some of my interests in developmental programming research. And so I've done a little bit of work looking at developmental programming, and kind of my phase of choice is in the third trimester. And we did some projects. We did one project looking at protein supplementation in late gestation. And we thought, you know, no one milks these beef cows. Let's check the colostrum and try and milk these cows and see if there's a difference between what we fed in the third trimester and our colostrum and milk composition. And we saw some differences. And so that kind of concept is that, you know, in the calf's early life, although they've been born, often their first couple meals can have a big impact on the direction of their life. And so, although when we think about colostrum, we're thinking about antibodies and IgGs, there is, you know, 50 or more other proteins that we know of, and those are the ones we just know of, that also are, you know, big bioactive components that have, you know, growth modulating potential and all sorts of other things. One area that we took a closer look at, and my PhD student who's defended now, Dr. Corinne Hare, who's now doing her postdoc at Saskatchewan, who I worked with Mike Steele, my colleague here. Mm-hmm. We saw differences in insulin in the colostrum with our protein supplementation. So that let us think, well, insulin is very stimulating for growth. And so we thought, well, maybe this colostrum that has been developed by what the cow's been eating in her third trimester, and, well, even more specifically, probably about 6 to 8 weeks before calving, maybe the concentration of the bioactives other than IgG can have an influence on the development of the calf. And so Corinne did this study. We did it in dairy bull calves because they're nice and inexpensive to use and can have good control over them and things like that. And so we fed 5 or 10 times the level of insulin in the colostrum to these little bull calves, and then euthanized them after their second meal and looked at gut development. And we saw some differences that the insulin seemed to stimulate some regions of the gut. And so, we think that programming effect from that first two meals could potentially have some longer term impacts on the growth and health and development of those young calves. And so, it's a super cool area. We did other work where we took some of the colostrum and sent it out for proteomics and lipidomics. And I think we had like 213 proteins that we characterized, and
wow,
40 of them were different with our nutritional treatment. So certainly a new area. And I'm not that much of an expert on kind of the bioinformatics side, but learning some of these things that are could potentially be in colostrum that can influence the calf is pretty cool.
That is so interesting. And just to think, I mean, just to have that thought of like, let's look at what's in that colostrum and how we can impact that. That's very, very interesting.
Yeah. And I mean, a little bit tough work to do. Not many people go and milk their beef cows. And
right. Yeah. Colostrum.
So I have to give credit to those students because they did a good job of doing that. And not easy research to do, but they were able to milk those beef cows out and get colostrum. And we have colostrum samples galore now that we can have fun with. So,
yeah. Oh, that's funny. That's really interesting, but also kind of amusing to visualize your students, you know, like getting the, doing the work. Yeah. So, yeah.
It's time for our famous three. Beta-carotene impacts reproductive performance in cattle. Because the main sources of beta-carotene are forages, most cattle don't get enough. Victus Transition from DSM Firmenich contains a blend of beta-carotene and mixed tocopherols, which provide needed vitamin A and antioxidants. Victus Transition provides better embryonic transfer and reproductive performance. Make sure your cattle get the beta-carotene they need with Victus Transition. Visit dsm.com/Victus Transition.
Well, let's change directions a bit. So we ask the same three questions of every guest on the show. Okay. And I gave you a heads up on these.
Yeah.
Listeners don't like to spring these on our guests very often, like just with no warning, because I don't think it's very fair. So I did give Dr. Wood a heads up on these. So the first one is, what is your favorite beef or cattle related book?
Yeah. So I pulled this one off my shelf, and this book was written by a Canadian rancher named Frank Jacobs. And I think he must have written it as a passion project. And it is the biggest love letter to cattle farming and ranching. It's written very lighthearted. It talks about, you know, the circle of worship being at these auction marts and the cattle industry in general. And it's just a fun, light read. And if you're passionate about cattle, it's a really kind of great read and also further drives your passion about being in such a great industry. So I doubt this is in print anymore, but if anyone can find it, it's a great read.
I'm going to have to look on Amazon. It is, and I don't think you actually said the title of it.
It's called Cattle and Us, Frankly Speaking.
Cattle and Us, Frankly Speaking, and it is by Frank Jacobs. And I am actually looking on Amazon as we speak for you. Can. It is paperback. And
let's see
here is, you can get it on Amazon for $23.
Awesome. Yeah. Highly recommend.
It is available. That is exciting. I'm actually, my husband, this episode will not be out before Christmas. So I'm actually going to get that for my husband because he will love that. He will absolutely love that. So that's a great recommendation. Thank you.
Yeah, no problem.
So the next book question, I just ruined it. The next question is, what is a book that is not related to the beef industry that's either like your favorite book or one that you're reading right now that's not about cattle?
Yeah, well, if we think about favorite book, and this is going back to me being a very big nerd as a child, but I love Harry Potter. And so I cannot say any other book besides the Harry Potter series is my favorite. Such a great read and definitely something that really sparked my interest in reading when I was kind of at that young age and made me want to read more. And so, little childish, but I still love those Harry Potter books and so many great memories.
It's not childish.
Yeah.
You have to pick one though, because I think there's 10 of them maybe? I don't know. I've never read them, but you have to pick one.
Probably by the third one, Prisoner of Azkaban is my favorite, I think. Yeah.
Okay. Prisoner of, I have heard that one before. My grandma, when they were first coming out, I think I was an older elementary or a young middle schooler, maybe when those books were first coming out. And I remember my grandma and grandpa got me like every book that had come out so far in the series, like hardcover, like nice hardcover. Yeah. books, and I took them to the bookstore and exchanged them for something different. It's just not my flavor of soup. So I was historical fiction is the word I'm trying to say. And so to this day, I still haven't read them, but I know that they are super popular. So you are obviously not alone with that. So
yeah. Yeah. And I was just at that perfect age, kind of same middle school type age, grade 9. And I was like, what is this book? And I read the first one and I was like, oh my gosh, this was so great. And and waited in line at midnight for the openings and ordered them off Amazon when Amazon only sold books.
Yeah.
Long ago, right?
A lot of people that don't know that it was just a bookstore and now it's literally everything store.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Showing my age and my gray roots a little bit maybe, but.
Well, mine are white. It's okay. It's okay. Well, that's great. So our last kind of like rapid fire question here, I guess, is when you think of someone you admire, what is a trait they have that has made them successful?
Yeah. I mean, oh gosh, there's so many things. I think for me, and someone, I saw this quote somewhere off an academic website, but, you know, we're all smart, distinguish yourself by being kind. And ooh. I think that, to heart when I try and teach and try and mentor my students, you know, everyone's smart in their own different way. If you can show some kindness, and some support to your students and your colleagues, I think that goes far and distinguishes you among others. So, yeah. And so that's kind of, and I don't know who said it, so I can't attribute it to anyone, but.
Well, I'm attributing it to you because I wrote it down. So it's now yours.
I definitely was not the originator of that one, but.
But I don't know who it was. So it's in my mind when I use it. It is from you, Dr. Wood. So that's a great, great mindset.
Yeah. And there's so many, I mean, I've had so many wonderful mentors in my life and through my academic career too. And when I look at some of them, they're also really good people. And I think that's really important too.
That's great. Yeah. What a great feel good way to wrap up our episode. Yeah. That's great. So that's all the questions we have and all the time we do have for today. Dr. Wood, thank you so much for joining us here on the Beef Podcast. I really learned a lot about several different topics and I appreciate that. And you exposed me to like four or five really great like bullet points here that are going to last me beyond the episode recording. So thank you very much for sharing your time and your talents with us here today on the podcast. If someone wants to learn more about you or your work at the University of Guelph or something like that, where can they do that?
Yeah. So most of our work goes out on a website and through I guess I don't call it Twitter anymore. X, I guess. beefguelph.ca is for all the beef focused research, but at Guelph, a lot of it is from our lab. We often post to Twitter. We have a lot of producer days. We'll have recordings of some of our producer events that go up on our website. It's a great way. You can subscribe to our newsletter off the website as well. We have kind of tidbits of research, what's happening, links to articles in the news from our work and all that kind of fun stuff. So that's probably the best way to get a hold of us.
All right. So I have written beefguelph.ca in the show notes and that followers can subscribe to your newsletter, the newsletter on that website. What is the X handle for those who'd like to follow?
It's also Beef Guelph.
Okay. But is there a period in it for CA or is it just Beef Guelph?
I think it's just Beef Guelph. Let me just pull it up here so I don't say it wrong.
Listeners, I am writing these things in the show notes that you can go down and check that out if you'd like to visit the Beef Guelph website or subscribe to their newsletter or follow them on Twitter, formerly X, formerly known as Twitter. You can do that as well. Is it Beef Guelph?
Yeah, Beef Guelph. Beef, capital, Guelph is a capital. Okay. Beef Guelph, yeah.
Awesome. So I put that in the show notes for our listeners. You guys can check out all the great research in many exciting areas coming out of the Beef Guelph, the department there. At the University of Guelph. So again, Dr. Wood, thank you so much for joining us today. I really enjoyed meeting you virtually and speaking with you, and thank you for sharing your time with us. So Thank you for joining us. And to our audience, I hope that you will join us next week on the Beef Podcast.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent from Brazil without the time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.